Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone, and good afternoon. Nice to see you all here in such big numbers. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture, jointly convened by the LSE European Institute, represented by MBEG, the Cañada Blanc Centre, and as part of the LSE Festival. My name is Andrés Rodríguez Posse. I am the Princesa de Asturias Chair and the Professor of Economic Geography here at the LSE, and I'm also the Director of the Cañada Blanc Centre. This year's festival is titled, with the characteristic modesty here at the LSE, How to Save the Planet. A fine ambition, though one detail tends to get lost between the communiques and the many photo opportunities that would arise. Saving the planet comes with a price, and a very large one for that sake. Consider the arithmetic. The European Investment Bank Group alone aims to mobilize 1 trillion euros this decade. For those of you that can do the math, that's a figure with 12 zeros, and it's only part of the bill. Public budgets cannot cover it, so most of the capital must come from private investors who, not unreasonably, would like to have some confidence of getting it back. Patient capital and a planet on an urgent deadline are not obvious bedfellows. Nor will the transition be felt evenly. One third of Europe's population, or 135 million people, live in regions that are quietly falling behind. And many of these places are vulnerable, not only to climate change, but to the very measures meant to address it. A transition that asks them to pay first and benefit last is not just unfair, it is a political accident waiting to happen. So here's the question of the hour. How does Europe mobilize investment on this scale and at this speed in a way that is socially and territorially fair, that strengthens our energy security, and that still leaves the planet better than what we found it? Can green finance be both patient and fast, both ambitious and bankable? And can the institution that signs the checks, in this case the EIB, also watch who gets left behind? To help us untangle all of this, we could not have a better guide. It's my great honor to host today here at this LSE Festival, Nadia Calviño, who is president of the European Investment Bank Group, arguably the largest public financial institution in the world, and the body who is now charged with turning Europe's climate ambitions into things that you can actually build rather than just announce. If anyone can talk about money and public good in the same breath, it is Nadia Calviño. An economist and a lawyer by training, she has spent more than three decades where economics, finance, and the public policy meet. She spent years in Brussels, latterly as the European Commission's Director General for Budget, which is to say that she has already run the European Union's accounts. She then served as Spanish government in a succession of senior economic portfolios that culminated as first vice president and minister of economy, trade and enterprise. And on the global stage, she has chaired the International Monetary Fund and Financial Committee of the IMF, the forum where the world's financial ministers gather to disagree in several languages all at once. So if you manage to actually deal with all these ministers, financing the green transition may, by comparison, feel almost restful. But most importantly for us, she has got a very strong connection to the LSE because two of her children, Alina and Danielle, were sitting precisely where you're sitting not that long ago. So I think that's the most important achievement that you have managed to get, is to have such wonderful children that actually come here and help transform society and the world. We're also very fortunate to have an outstanding discussant who is going to make things difficult, I think, for Nadia. So usually,
of course.
Complicated. Ian Begg is professorial research fellow at the LSE's European Institute and one of this country's sharpest authorities on the political economy of European integration, EU economic governance, and that eternal puzzle of how the EU budget might actually be reform. And I would like to pick your brains later on about this, because it's the negotiations are ongoing. He will respond to Nadia Calviño's remarks, and I suspect he will have one or two questions of your own. But of course, you did not come here to listen to me. And you will be relieved to hear that I'm finishing. However, I want to give you a brief word on questions. For those of you that will be itching to actually come and ask questions to Nadia Calviño. We want, and we always aspire at the LSE for a lively exchange. But a lively exchange needs questions, not speeches. So if you have a thesis to advance, register to a PhD or write a blog post, but don't do it here. If you have a question to ask, do yourself and the rest of us a favor by beginning your question with why, how, what, which, or to what extent. It's a helpful exercise, and it will work wonders, and you look far more intelligent and incisive than if you give a speech here. If you don't, I'll be merciless. I'll cut you off faster than you can say geopolitical uncertainty, which takes a while. And as is a tradition at the LSE, we have a lot of hot shots here, but students have got the privilege of going first in all questions. With that, Nadia, the floor is entirely yours.
Well, thank you very much, Andres, for that very, very kind introduction. And you already revealed that I have a very special place in my heart for the London School of Economics for many reasons. And so it is really a rare and a unique pleasure to be here today. Dear Ambassador, dear Professor, dear Ambassadors, I hadn't seen you. Thank you for coming. Dear Professors, dear Andres and Ian. Dear students, dear faculty members, it's such a pleasure to be here again at the London School of Economics. And not only because I have a personal relationship with this institution and it's full of dear friends, but because the London School of Economics has long been a place where ideas meet action, where economic thinking is connected to the practical questions that shape our societies. And actually, it is the incubator, or rather, it is the accelerator of the leaders of tomorrow. So it is a great opportunity to be able to address you today and share with you some thoughts on some of the current issues that are bothering all of us and that will have a structural impact on our economies and our societies. Geopolitical changes and conflicts. Emerging global powers and shifting strategic alliances, the impact of artificial intelligence and other disruptive technologies. I am sure that Ian is going to tackle some of these issues in his questions and comments. There is around us huge volatility and uncertainty, and that spreads a feeling of insecurity to citizens around the world. And I'm sure you feel it. I'm sure you see it around you. And all these together with the growing impact of climate change, which seems to have gone down the public attention hit parade, partly due to turnarounds of the political narrative in some countries, but I think also because of the overflow, the sheer rhythm of news and issues that are occupying our space, our brain space, our media. The historical developments that we are living every day, many times a day, actually. And that makes this issue, climate change and climate action, feature less when we are looking around and reading the news. But actually, I think this should feature as the top priority on its own merits, because it is good for our planet, but also because it is very closely linked to all of the above, all these other concerns that I have mentioned a moment ago. And in this context, the question that we are discussing today, which I agree with Andres, this could have sounded a bit arrogant and a bit excessive in the past, actually, but I think that the question is spot on as the defining one of our time. How do we save the planet? Now, I would suggest that as economists, policymakers, researchers, future leaders, we begin by framing it correctly. because the challenge in front of us is not abstract, it is not distant, it is not only environmental. Climate change is already affecting our economies, our competitiveness, our public finances, our security, our social cohesion. The growing costs of extreme weather events are a clear reminder of the need to tackle this challenge. So this is not only about protecting nature, and that would be reason enough, I'm sure, for many of you, but it is not only about what is the right thing to do. It is rather about what is the smart thing to do to preserve prosperity, stability, opportunity, our way of life for future generations. So in my view, climate action must not be understood as an alternative to other pressing priorities, from security to competitiveness, as some want to portray it. But it is not a constraint on growth, as some also are repeatedly wanting to frame it. But it is a central pillar of economic efficiency and sustainable prosperity. Now, I have to admit, today, this is perceived to be a very European perspective. Because Europe has always, or at least for the past 80 years, understood that prosperity and solidarity have to go hand in hand. And this is the underlying cause of the phenomenal success of of our continent for the past 80 years, since the end of World War II. Furthermore, Europe is at the forefront of the impact of climate change and also the vulnerabilities that come from excessive dependence on fossil fuels, as we have certainly discovered, if we didn't know it before, I will come back to this in a minute, with the Russia's attempt to invade Ukraine and, of course, the escalation of the crisis in the Middle East. In Europe, we know that long-term investment matters, that resilience matters, because every euro we invest in adaptation and prevention saves 5 to 7 euros in repairs, not to talk about the losses that are irreparable, like the loss of human lives. And we Europeans, we also know that collective challenges require collective solutions. And if we look at the history of European integration, some of the greatest advances come in response to profound challenges. After the war, Europe invested in peace. After the great financial crisis, we strengthened our institutions. After the pandemic, we mobilized together at unprecedented scale public and private investment to address the shock from the health, economic, and social points of view. And I think that today, climate change requires the same ambition, the same unity and determination. But let me also be very clear, saving the planet is not about one single policy. There is not a magic wand, there is no silver bullet. This is about transforming the way we produce energy, the way we move people and goods, we build our cities, we manage water, we grow food, we finance innovation, and this is an economic transformation of historic scale. And transformations of this magnitude require investment, and you have already mentioned, and time, very substantial investment, and the numbers are well known, sustained for a long period of time. And the current decade is key to make this transition a success, notwithstanding national political changes, conflicting priorities, urgent needs. And this is precisely why institutions like the European Investment Bank play a key role in ensuring that we make the green transition a European success. Because the European Investment Bank Group is the climate bank of the European Union. More and more, I have the feeling it is the climate bank of the world, as many institutions are no longer even using the word. But most importantly, our institution is focusing on long-term impact. The role of the EIB is to support projects that strengthen Europe's competitiveness and security with a multi-annual approach that complements national, budgetary, and political cycles. And this is very relevant. Since the adoption of the Climate Bank Roadmap, we have significantly increased financing for climate and environmental projects to reach 57 billion euros in 2025. That's 60% of the total. We are on track to mobilize these 1 trillion euros in this decade with public and private investment, and we have doubled financing for energy since Russia started the aggression against Ukraine. So actually, the European Investment Bank Group is currently the main financier of the energy transition in Europe, currently financing half of the grid projects going on, 1 out of 5 solar plants, 1 out of 3 onshore wind parks, and the majority of offshore wind projects. I could mention many projects in Poland, but let me just mention one that was signed, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes ago, actually, which is going to be financing the largest onshore wind farm in the Baltic countries, in Lithuania in this case. It is a very important project. It is really a game changer. It will actually provide energy to 1/3 of the population of the country. Beyond Europe, we're also working globally. For example, contributing to the Mission 300 with the World Bank and the African Development Bank. We have recently pledged 1 billion euros to expand access to clean, affordable electricity across Africa for 300 million persons by the end of the decade. And it is quite clear that the public sector has been leading and supporting this process for the past 5 years, but the scale of the challenge requires the private sector to get active. Okay, just to go back to where we were talking about private investment, what is the role of institutions like the European Investment Bank? Well, we have a catalytic role to play. We need to mobilize this private investment, reducing risk, crowding in this financing, sealing with a seal of quality those projects that can really make a difference on the ground. Because ultimately, what matters is not only innovation, it is also implementation. We already have many of the technologies we need, and this is very good news. Renewable energy, storage, grid modernization, clean transport, energy efficiency, sustainable industrial processes, adaptation infrastructure. What a pity, coming here just to record a video. Anyway, the question is no longer whether the solutions exist, the question is whether we can deploy them fast enough, fairly enough, and at sufficient scale. So let me run very fast through the final points that I wanted to share with you. I would like to emphasize one word that actually Professor Rodriguez-Posse already mentioned, which is fairness. Because transitions only succeed when people believe they are fair. Multiplying the success stories can actually translate the positive impact of this green transition in our economies. And that means we need to show the impact of our policies when it comes to more stability, stronger security, and lower energy bills. If climate action is seen as something imposed from above, it will face resistance. If regions feel they are left behind, the transition will lose legitimacy. If households feel only the costs, not the benefits, then the clean transition is perceived to be only affordable to some, and then we lose this discussion. And that's why the green transition needs to be also a just transition. And actually, competitiveness and cohesion, I go back to the same idea, are just two sides of the same coin. Now, the same applies globally because climate change does not recognize borders, and so developing economies also need to have access to affordable finance, and international cooperation remains essential in this regard. I was very happy to hold a meeting today with Baroness Chapman, precisely in the run-up to the presidency of the G20 by the United Kingdom next year. How can we join forces so that we make sure that there is finance for development, finance for the clean transition around the world? And that also makes it, I think, prominent, the role of multilateral institutions. Multilateral institutions matter. Partnerships matter. If we get it right, we strengthen more than our energy system. We power real progress. We strengthen trust in our democracies and our institutions, as well as the multilateral system. And I think this provides a broader view of what we are discussing and the role of institutions like the European Investment Bank. Let me share a final thought with you. And many people tell me, oh, you are always so positive. You're always so optimistic. Is this idealism? And I don't think so. I think this is sheer realism. And when I speak with students, many of you are talking about the one question that Professor Rodriguez-Posse did not mention, which is when? When? Because many, many young people are feeling that the change is not fast enough, that we're moving too slowly, that progress is insufficient. And I understand that concern, but I would also say this. Transformation at scale is happening. It has moved to a new phase, which is much more led by the private sector. It is accelerating. Of course, the crises around us are good wake-up calls, you know, to all institutions and private companies to realize they need to actually move ahead faster. Look at the speed of renewable deployment. I just mentioned it. Look at innovation in clean technologies. We already have the tools to make this a success. Look at the evolution of sustainable finance. The success of the green bond market is a good message. Look at the increasing percentage of companies that are investing in energy efficiency and in the green transition of their businesses. So I think that we need to bypass public rhetoric and ideological positions and focus on what is really happening. And there's an energy transition which is in full swing. And current geopolitical developments will increase this trend because I think it's quite clear that we Europeans, the EU, the UK alike, we need to break free from our excessive dependence on fossil fuels. So the way forward is clear. We do have the tools to do this. It is not only the right path for the planet, it is also Europe's strongest economic strategy. Progress is not always linear, but it is real. It requires persistence. And then this brings me to my final question, which is who should lead this? I got this question just from one of your colleagues for a podcast a moment ago. And let me reply to this question. It's all of you. It's all of us. Because when we are asked how to save the planet, we're also asking who will lead this transformation? And the answer is you will. Not only activists, not only scientists, not only political leaders, it's economists, it's engineers, lawyers, entrepreneurs, investors, public servants, researchers, designers, data specialists. Every profession represented in this university has a role to play. Because climate action is no longer a niche issue, it is becoming central to every major economic decision, what infrastructure we finance, what technologies we scale, how we price risk, how we regulate markets, how companies define long-term risks and value. And these are the decisions that will shape the future, and many of you will be the ones making those decisions. And that's why I am really confident every time I meet with a group of young students that we will be successful in tackling this challenge like we human beings have done always throughout our history. Europe has a particular responsibility. I think we will discuss that in the debate in a moment. And in my view, optimism and confidence is not naivete. It's not being naive. It is a strategic choice because building the future requires confidence that change is possible. And I know it is. I know it because at the European Investment Bank, we see every day what becomes possible when public purpose and private investment work together. And when we look back, we see what we have achieved by joining our forces. And that's what gives me confidence. So how do we save the planet? By investing in innovation, by accelerating implementation, by ensuring fairness, by strengthening our unity and international cooperation, and by understanding that climate action is not separate from economic efficiency and security. It is central to it. The choices made in this decade will shape the lives of generations to come, and that is a profound responsibility. But it is also an extraordinary opportunity, and I'm really proud to be at the helm of an institution that can make a difference for the future, trying to make the right choices every day. Thank you very much and looking forward to the exchange.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So now, Ian, your turn.
I can move my chair back in now. Right. Thank you, Nadia, for, as always, I've known you quite some time now, since we first met in the EU budget discussions for a very illuminating discussion, as always. And I should let everybody know, especially students, that she is great at taking on student questions. But I'm not here to praise you, am I? I'm here to cause trouble. Try to be provocative. A first question, and maybe I'll just run through this because we've lost a little bit of time with the interruption. I'll run through the general comments and then you can react to them. Scale. The EU budget, as we all know, is small. It's one percentage point approximately of EU GDP. If I'm correct, the European Investment Bank's annual lending is of the order of 100 billion. How is that going to make a significant difference given all the other demands on EU spending, EU lending and so on? Is the trick going to be to use the InvestEU model where the EIB's contribution is to provide guarantees and the capacity to multiply the amount of money actually dispersed by the order of 15 or even 20 in the next multi-annual financial framework? Or do we face what sometimes is referred to in the debate on the EU as a foreign policy actor as a expectations, contributions dilemma? Capability, expectations in a clash. We cannot do what we think we should do. Second sort of question is today's agenda. You mentioned in your introductory remarks that somehow climate change was slipping down the list of priorities. Defence is accelerating up that list of priorities. We see it very much in the UK at present, with a big wrangle going on in the UK government about why they are unable to spend more on defence. Now here there's two sorts of dilemmas. There's defence against net zero, but there's also defence and net zero against welfare spending. And here we need to recall that Article 3 of the Treaty on European Union refers to sustainable development as being not just environmental, but also economic and social. Do things like the Just Transition Fund at EU level, which is being squeezed a bit in the proposals for the next round of the EU budget, do they do enough to promote a just transition in circumstances in which energy prices are rising and making it harder and harder for the relatively poor families to afford energy? So we have difficult, hard economic choices there to make. On investing in renewables, one of the big questions, assuming we don't want to follow Trump in saying drill, baby, drill, is whether to support the nuclear industry, either the big-scale nuclear reactors or the small modular reactors, which some see as being a solution given the difficulties of implementing both solar and wind-related power. And it may be that this is a very hard choice for the EIB because in some circles, nuclear is verboten, to use a good German word. Then we all think artificial intelligence has opportunities but has risks. One of the big risks in the context of climate change is its power consumption. From what I've read, the amount of energy, particularly electricity, that's going to be devoted to artificial intelligence will double in the next 5 years to very high levels. And that doubling is going to see it overtaking Europe's energy-intensive industries like aluminium or steelmaking to become a huge new source of demand. Are we able to factor in that particular complication in trying to work out whether the potential advantages of AI in doing things more cheaply and more energy efficiently are not outweighed by the cost of producing the results of it? And one last topic, which I think always has to be confronted in this context, is, I'm sure he's a good friend of yours, Mario Draghi. He produced a report saying Europe was becoming increasingly uncompetitive. The word competitiveness is very hard to define, and Andres and I have struggled with this particular expression over 20 years now, I think it's Andres, yes, trying to work out what it means. But somehow it's the sense that Europe is lagging behind the United States and even more so China in developing new industries, in the opportunities to conquer world markets. So here are two or three questions. The first is the European Investment Bank, especially if it's being pulled more in the direction of sustainable investment in energy-saving capabilities, Is it well aligned with the Draghi Report's concerns about European competitiveness and the prescriptions which it comes forward with, which tend to edge away from the von der Leyen Green Deal of 5 or 6 years ago? So that's a big challenge. High energy costs are identified in the Draghi Report as being one of the major obstacles to European competitiveness. Now, they arise for very straightforward reasons. We've been weaned off cheap Russian gas, especially in Germany and Austria. We are trying to develop the alternatives, the green energies of the future, but the cost level is such that European manufacturers are shooting themselves in the foot by having to pay too much for energy. Now, is this a blip that we see energy prices go up because we're investing in renewables and then come down when renewables become the mainstay of European energy? Or are we pursuing a policy which is going to damage us for quite some time? Which again brings me back to the scale of investment. You and I have debated the European budget before. We know how difficult it is to change it. I will rise to Andres's challenge about how to explain what's going on later. But can the European budget, European Investment Bank, the various other ways in which the European entities are raising money outside the standard budgetary framework really add up to enough of an impact to fulfill the objectives which we can possibly all agree on? And one thing I should reveal, because Andres forgot to mention it, is these two are childhood friends. Now, isn't that a magic element, as well as having two children here? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Well,
I told you that Ian was going to have quite a few questions, so
yes.
Nadia, please.
But you nailed it, Ian, because right now it's all about scale and speed. Europe is on the right track. Manager, the general manager, I think that's the name of the position of the International Energy Agency, visited our headquarters last week, and he, in a nutshell, said that Europe is on the right track, but you need to do more and faster. So it's all about scale and speed. And here is where the European Investment Bank has a very important role to play, because as you said, every euro of public guarantees from the European budget, we can multiply times 15 or even 20, because we mobilize our own capital and then private investment. And that is surely going to play a very important role in having the impact which is needed. I am very confident on the power of technology, and I'm not an engineer, so I'm an economist and a lawyer, as you said before, but I have a lot of trust in the power of technology, and I am quite confident that the European Investment Bank is going to be financing the technologies that make a difference for the future and allow us to save energy, to be more efficient, to bring cheaper energy to our households and businesses. And you know why I'm so confident? Because we are hitting at everything that moves. So there is no technological innovation in Europe that is not financed by the European Investment Bank. And I was very happy to discover, and that's why I'm also very confident, that, you know, the vaccine production capacity, the BioNTech company, guess who had financed this research when nobody was trusting? The European Investment Bank. And right now, from nuclear, you mentioned, to solar, wind, the components that go into these technologies, energy efficiency, circular economy, green steel, green hydrogen, new fuels, everything we are financing, wherever there is an innovative project that is a good project, of course, at least it looks good, you know. Of course, sometimes you succeed, sometimes you don't, and that's what the public sector is for, to take that risk. But wherever there is this project, the European Investment Bank is financing it. And that's why I'm quite confident that we will see important developments like we have seen with renewables. The price of renewables was much higher some years ago. It has gone down. The cost of this generation has gone down. So a final reflection on the many reports that exist, because there has been a Draghi report, a Letta report. I was jokingly saying to an Italian journalist this morning that whenever there's an issue, we look for our next Italian prime minister. And
before that, it was Monti.
Yes, absolutely, it was Monti. So it's also Finnish prime minister, also very, very well known for delivering this kind of European reports. And all of them, at the end of the day, in a nutshell, they say that what Europe needs to do, I like the concept of productivity more than competitiveness, in that competitiveness is putting you in relative terms to someone else, whereas productivity is more like playing your own turf, you know, and trying to go to your maximum yourself. What we need is market integration, you know, full power of 450 million citizens, even more after the accession takes place, the enlargement takes place, which is making progress this week as we speak. Large-scale investment, which we are discussing. Simplification, and I would add, without losing the coherence of the rules, because that gives legal certainty to the private sector to invest. And then strong international partnerships. So everybody agrees on what needs to be done, and that's why I wanted in my introductory remarks to put the focus on implementation. Because I think everybody knows, everybody agrees. Now the important thing is to get on with it and do it fast. I hope that the upcoming leaders meeting later this week will confirm that there is this unity, this determination, because things are moving. Minds are focusing, and we do see it from the European Investment Bank, despite the noise around us.
Okay. Ian, I don't know if you have... So we have now time for the audience, so please raise your hands, and let me see. I have to put my glasses, because otherwise I'm not going to... We'll start with a question over there. The woman... Yeah, so...
Wait for the microphone.
I wait for the microphone. Say your name and just ask your question.
Hello, Kava Spitzer. Thank you for the talk. I was wondering, you mentioned green growth is possible, but to what extent do you think GDP is an adequate measure for growth, and what would be possible alternatives? Thank you.
We're going to accumulate three questions, so another raise of hands. Yes, over here. Yeah, in blue. Yeah, there's a microphone.
Hi, my name is Ravisha. I just want to talk about, you know, the competitiveness between Europe and America. Would, you know, if you look at startup funding, the difference between Europe and America is always another zero in terms of private equity, VC, whatever. Is the EIB thinking of, you know, investing more into startups?
And final question, yeah, over there at the back.
Hi, I'm Ashish from India. Thanks for your lovely talk. Now, my question is, when we talk about a sustainable planet, it's not only about West, we should also consider East. Now, there is always a debate why, who should be contributing more towards a greener planet. Now, the entire East, including India, is in the phase of high growth of infrastructure. So the question is, all the world, all the world financial institution, be it EU or the World Bank or IMF, in what measure they should contribute equity towards the attaining the sustainable growth, so that, you know, it's like equal between the East and West, is my question. Thank you.
So Nadia, please.
Yeah, very, very good question. So you have very smart students in this, the very, very good questions. And I really love that the first question I get is about GDP as a measure for growth. Because when I was a minister in Spain, shortly after having been appointed, and some colleagues are here that joined me in that period will confirm, I launched a process called Beyond GDP. And we are working very closely with the OECD and with the European Commission to try to identify not alternative, but rather complementary indicators, because it is quite clear that GDP does not adequately reflect the digital economy. It doesn't adequately reflect green assets. Something is not right when there's a fire. Actually, GDP goes up because of the expenditure in extinguishing the fire or repairing the woods, but healthy green woods do not feature. Yeah? So we need to find complementary indicators. I think this is really a very important task. I know many institutions have been working on them, but we haven't been successful in replacing GDP as an indicator, except for Bhutan. We had the... we had the Prime Minister of Bhutan visiting our headquarters last year, actually. It was very interesting to discuss this index, this happiness index, which is not perfect either. So probably there is no one miracle indicator. We need to use a full set of them. And I'm sure in the LSE you are working on this and you have a set of these indicators to make the right decisions. Very good question on the startups. And this is an obsession that we have because Europe is a superpower. I like saying it. Let me say it again. Europe is a superpower. And when we spend 24 hours a day hearing how people are saying, oh, no, technologically behind. Okay. Of course, we need to scale up. Of course, we need to be faster. Of course, we need to address the challenges. But the ecosystem of startups in Europe is comparable to the US. Europe has universities that are second to none and research centers second to none in the world. We have some of the technological leaders of the world in areas from health to aerospace. What quantum computing and other key areas. What we need is to make sure that ideas, technologies, and companies that are born here in Europe can scale up in Europe. So it's all about scale and speed, as I said a moment ago. Now, the European Investment Bank is the main financier, and it is worrying in the sense because, and Brexit obviously had a very important role to play in this, since we are remembering this week, you know, that what to me were very sad developments, starting with Joe Cox's murder and then the referendum decision. But the Brexit had a very important impact on financial markets in Europe. That's very clear. And we have been trying to catch up and scale up Europe's capital markets, but there is a gap vis-à-vis the US. It is closing, but not fast enough. Now, the European Investment Bank Group actually represents around 30% of venture debt in Europe, in the EU, and 25% of venture capital in the EU. I say I regret it, because if the market were larger, then we would represent a smaller share. But what we want to do is scale up that positive impact, which has enabled us to create 12 unicorns in the last couple of years. So we are, again, on the right track, but we need to now scale up. And this is exactly our top priority in the coming weeks and months. How can we scale up these instruments and the impact? So yes, we're very interested in investing in startups through the private venture capital system in the EU. And actually, we have been indirectly investing in startups here in the UK, because we invest in funds and those funds invest in the UK. And around 10% of the project of the funds of this scale-up instrument have come to startups here in the UK. And I think that's a very good message to all of us also. And then the question about East and West, I think, is spot on. Because, well, the global order is changing in front of our eyes. It's clear. And the future is not going to be similar to what we had before. And one of the reasons for that change is that there are emerging economies like India, like South Africa, like Brazil, like Mexico, Indonesia, that want to have a stronger voice and take their own destiny in their hands. And they are right to say, we want to have a stronger voice. And they also say, well, all right for the clean transition, but we want to benefit from this process too. And in that regard, I am proud to say that our institution is actually financing very important projects of clean transport, of water, circular economy all around the world, co-investing with the World Bank, with the Asian Development Bank, the African Development Bank, to try to make sure, as I mentioned a moment ago with the Mission 300, that this global challenge is actually tackled globally and through solidarity at world level.
Thank you very much. Another round of questions. One over here, and then I'll go on this side.
Thank you, Nadia, for coming. My name is Alvaro. And I wanted to ask you, to what extent are we not becoming more dependent on Chinese solar panel production, since one of the main objectives, like economic objectives of the green transition, is precisely becoming less dependent on Russian and petrol states oil. Thank you so much.
Okay, so over here.
Hi, Nadia. Thanks very much for the talk. My name is Alex. I'm a student here at the LSE. My question is crowding out. How does the EIB look at crowding out. You mentioned that crowding in is great. You can get 15 times the money from the private sector. How does the EIB...
And now to do justice, I think we should take some questions from the people online. There's a question from Tim Root of the Haringey Friends of Earth. What steps should the EU and other governments take to reduce the still massive financing of fossil fuels by commercial banks?
Not only are they good questions, but they are super short. You really scared them. Okay, they're really disciplined.
They are incisive, that's the point.
Yeah, no, very good. So that's spot on. Because we have to reduce our excessive dependence on fossil fuels. We have to reduce our excessive dependence on the US for defense. But we cannot then have excessive dependence on technologies coming from other parts of the world. So it is very important to develop our homegrown capacities. I mentioned before how we are financing key components of solar and wind power. And I was very happy, actually, a couple of weeks ago, and you are Spanish, are you not? We are financing, for example, a producer of solar inverters, which is like the brain of the solar panel, in Spain. There are others in Europe. We are doing a market study to identify them to try to see how we can provide the necessary financing so that we can scale up our own capacities. I think this is a very important area because we don't want to discover 2 years from now that actually we have now another security relevant dependency when it comes to technologies. Now, crowding out, very good point. So whenever we assess a project, we need to assess the additionality. To what extent can this project be financed by the market? Is there sufficient private investment coming in? And I'm happy to hear from our investors, clients, that they very much value the financing by the EIB, but they also value very much the technical assessment. So our standards are so high that whenever a company gets financed by the EIB or the bank or the fund, our subsidiary that invests in equity, in private investment funds, there's a seal of quality that mobilizes other investors. So we're always very mindful that if the market can finance a project, we shouldn't be there. But if there is a catalytical role, we should come in, and that is an issue that we need to absolutely be very vigilant about. It's the aim of the EIB is not doing volumes, it's not doing business, it's having an impact, you know, that reflects our political priorities. And then, a very good question, how can we reduce financing of fossil fuels? And here, I think investment and the message that is coming from financial institutions like the European Investment Bank that stopped financing fossil fuels in 2019 is important. But I think more important is the regulatory framework and that there would be coherence. And of course, if there would be coherence at global level, then it would be perfect. This was the Paris Agreement. This was the whole green finance environment that was developed afterwards. I tend to think that when things make sense, they will prevail. And so it's very important to keep the course, look for ways to manage this phase that we're going through. Because at the end of the day, excessive dependence on fossil fuels is a risk. I think that we have seen it very clearly with the escalation of the conflict in the Middle East, more recently, but also with Russia's attempt to invade Ukraine. And so it is a risk on the balance sheet of a financial institution. Coherent regulatory framework is probably the best way forward.
Okay, so in order to finish on time, we have the last round of questions, and we're going to start there at the back. And then we go that way.
Thank you. Juan Pedro García Arce from the Local Economic Development Program here at the LSE. My question is, with the dependence of fossil fuels as well as the big demand for energy for AI data centers, is the European Investment Bank have any plans to invest again into nuclear in any way? Thank you.
One question over here.
Thank you. Hi, Anya Ekpo, LSE Alumni, Urbanization and Development. My question is, the title of the conversation is Mobilizing Investment, and you speak about venture capital as financing startups. And so my question is, what is your thoughts on a more Singaporean or even Chinese model of picking winners, and what do you do about solving issues like water scarcity, not on a sectoral basis?
Okay, and final question, sorry for all those that have your hands up, but from online, Shivangi Bose, who is did environmental economics here at the LSE. Where do you see the biggest challenge in transitioning to a green economy, and are there solutions to that challenge that exist?
Mm-hmm. I would like to start with the last one, because at the end of my reply, I want to pick your brains and leave you with a question to the young brains in the room. But what is the main challenge? I think the main challenge is, as Ian said, and I said in my introductory remarks, is attention. No, this, you need to focus on this as a very important issue. And of course, with the wars and the needs to invest in defense and the needs to invest in other areas and to protect our social infrastructures, by the way, because this is the European way of life, this is our strength and political stability, it is clear that public attention has moved elsewhere. But the problem is not going away. And that's why I wanted to share the good news that what we see in our surveys is that more than 90% of European companies are investing in the green transition. They understand that energy efficiency reduces their energy bills, that having renewables reinforces their security. And this is also linked to the issue of the data centers and artificial intelligence, because more and more these companies themselves are looking at circular water circuits, for example, self-sustained energy generation systems that can respond to that need. I think it is a challenge, don't get me wrong, but I think that people are aware of that challenge and it will need to be addressed. From the European Investment Bank's perspective, we have invested in nuclear. For many years, there have not been projects in Europe. We are currently assessing a number of small modular reactor projects. We also have financed, for example, nuclear fuel recycling and treatment systems, security enhancing, decommissioning systems, safety enhancement. So many investments are being financed by the European Investment Bank. We finance all those technologies that can be critical for the green transition. And there was this this other question, which maybe we need 2 hours, about picking the winners. Now, should we pick the winners? I am a believer in the market identifying those winners, but it is very important that we take measures that ensure that those winners can actually emerge and can grow. And this also means, as I said a moment ago, supporting the scaling up, but also supporting that these innovators are acquired by people that are interested in developing their capacities and not just stopping that technological development, which I fear, you know, could be the case in some areas. As powerful as the European economy is in areas like industrial, like design, like I mentioned some sectors a moment ago, I think we have every interest in allowing this ecosystem of startups to grow and prosper in Europe. If I would have to tell current political leaders what is the priority in terms of the economic competitiveness and productivity, I would say market integration. Give companies a whole internal market that they can grow in and provide the financing so that they can become global champions. But I wanted to pick your brains, leave you with a question. So this morning I was in an interview where we were talking about how do you feel in the current geopolitical context, what is the role of Europe? And many times the feeling is that there are two big elephants and they are fighting. They are fighting, and where is Europe in all of this? Well, Europe should not be the grass under the elephants. I think we all agree on that. But what animal would describe Europe? And we were this morning we were discussing, no? And on the one hand, it's a whale, because it keeps the balance and the equilibrium in the oceans. and is playing in a different league because it is not the fighting elephants. It's rule of law, it's multilateral frameworks, it's win-win solutions, it's cooperation, it's trade and investment deals. On the other hand, we are like honeybees. So it's more like a constant zoom, lots of action, lots of coordination, implicit coordination. It's a shared leadership at the end of the day, e pur si muove. And I have used many times the image of a rhinoceros. So right now our horn is maybe not so sharp, but once we address the weaknesses in defense and financing, well, you don't want to upset a rhino, would you? And it's a sturdy, resilient animal that is in the same playground. I want to pick your brains. You know, I would be interested if you have suggestions as to what kind of animal would Europe be, and how do we articulate Europe, not only the EU, also the UK. What unites us? What are the values that unite us? How do we identify ourselves? And how can we play an important role in shaping the new global order that is in the making? So if you want to send your suggestions, I'm very interested to know your views. Thank you.
Thank you. I will like to finish this.
Can I have two words?
So, go ahead.
Maybe we could start with sleeping tiger.
Crouching tiger, was it? Anyway, I would like to finish without thanking a few people. First and foremost, Nadia Calviño, for having the generosity and the will to come to the LSE and speak in the open without any sort of barriers and give what has been a fantastic and wonderful presentation. So please thank you for a round of applause. Second, Ian Begg, who has been the discussant and as usual, as always, doing a fantastic job. The whole team at the LSE Festival and the security for the wonderful job they have done during this period. And then finally and foremost, all of you. Especially those of you that are here at the LSE, for devoting 1 hour of your time to come to this very interesting event, but especially because Nadia said, and I think she's absolutely right, that you're the ones who are going to transform the world. But in order to transform the world, especially those of you that are doing dissertations right now, you have to get the evidence right, do the right analysis, and then with those facts, that evidence, go and use dialogue to convince everyone that there's a brighter future and that you are the one shaping it. So give yourself a big round of applause and thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.